I'm Ted Davis. I'm moderating this session this morning on history of science. There'll be three papers, and they are not all equally long. The first two papers, including question and answers, will be 45 minutes, and the final paper, including question and answers, will be 30 minutes. That's the way this particular session has been set up. And the first of our speakers this morning is Bethany Solerator, who is a graduate student in science and religion at Regent College in Vancouver. She's currently working on her thesis in evolutionary theodicy. When not cloistering herself in the library, Bethany enjoys a variety of sports from swimming to fencing. This morning, she will be talking about Charles Darwin's exchange with Asa Gray on design. So I'm just going to go turn the lights down, and then we can go ahead.
Well, thank you this morning for being here. I hope you guys are ready to go. I have a whole lot of material to get through. So don't just politely sip at your coffee. Please gulp it down and buckle up. Let's start. The universe we observe, we are told, has precisely the properties that we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. In the contemporary debate on design, these words from Richard Dawkins are pretty paradigmatic of one extreme of the debate. On the other end of the movement, we have folks like from the intelligent design movement, like we've got Philip Johnson, Michael Behe, William Dembski. And these folks believe that we can infer design through observing instances of irreducible or specified complexity. With the way books are streaming off the presses on this topic, we might think that this is simply a modern debate, but in fact, it reaches back hundreds of years. 150 years ago, immediately after the publication of The Origin of Species, the conversation was revived again, and Charles Darwin was caught in the thick of it. Darwin's views on design are not only interesting in their own right, they are also important because how they are closely linked to Darwin's belief in God. The temptation, writes John Headley Brooke, to ascribe Darwin's loss of faith to his science has been irresistible. The question naturally arises, how did Darwin's investigation of the natural world shape his views of nature, and where do these beliefs fit in the larger context of Darwin's belief? Today, we will look at some of Darwin's most candid statements on natural design, which come from a close correspondence that he had with the Harvard botanist Asa Gray. The correspondence was between 1860 and 1863. Gray had written several essays reviewing Darwin's Origin of Species, and it is in response to these articles that Darwin wrote warmly and somewhat, as we will see, confusedly to his American friend. These letters provide a very interesting snapshot of Darwin's beliefs in design right after The Origin of Species was published. As Darwin pondered these issues, he found that he could not actually assent to the idea that intelligent design could be found in the natural world. Before we go on, I want to say that by intelligent design, I don't mean the contemporary ideas put forward by the intelligent design movement, but rather the long-standing Christian recognition that the universe has a rationality or an architecture that reflects the work of a creator, in which investigating the natural world was a way of thinking God's thoughts after him. Darwin could not recognize this, I will argue, because the great naturalist was irrevocably tethered to William Paley's ideas of how design would be... All right, hang on. Too far away, would be manifested in the physical realm. So by exclusively accepting Paley's standards of how design is perceived in nature, Darwin was unable to see design or mind at work in the evolutionary scheme. In contrast, Asa Gray was able to embrace natural theology and evolution by leaving behind Paley's categories. So how did Paley, in fact, influence Darwin? There are three major ways. The first was in his education. Darwin's interaction with Paley came early in his studies at Cambridge in 1828, where he attended Christ College, the same college that Paley had attended. The study of this famous alum was an integral part of Darwin's education. As he later recalled, in order to pass the BA examination, it was also necessary to get up Paley's evidences of Christianity and his moral philosophy. This was done in a thorough manner, and I am convinced that I could have written out the whole of the evidences with perfect correctness, but not, of course, in the clear language of Paley. The logic of this book, as I may add, of his natural theology, gave me as much delight as did Euclid. So the young biologist eagerly adopted the Paleian synthesis. Darwin reflected, "I did not at that time trouble myself about Paley's premises, and taking these on trust, I was charmed and convinced by the long line of argumentation." The influence that Paley had on Darwin directly can hardly be underestimated. Yet Paley's influence ran far deeper than simply writing a textbook that Darwin admired. Paley both represented and buttressed some of the foundational beliefs of mid-Victorian culture. Paley's understanding of design was drawn from the assumption that all of life was set into a specific place with a specific function by divine order. This is an idealistic concept of reality that was found even earlier in Isaac Newton's idea of the well-ordered universe, and earlier than that in the medieval conception of the great chain of being, which you can see here stretching from God all the way down to minerals. So this idea of order extended to everything from the placement of organs in the body to the social structuring of the English class system. So because of this, if you're arguing either for or against design in, say, nature or the body, you could also be inadvertently arguing against the place of the king, or in this case the queen, at the top of the social hierarchy, which is a rather dangerous thing to do. These beliefs of divine order were also very strongly reflected in the church, as the famous hymn, "All Things Bright and Beautiful," written in 1848, attests to in its third and often omitted verse, "The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate. God made them high or lowly and ordered their estate." Very comfortable feeling when you're working in a slum in Liverpool. So thus, when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species almost 60 years after Paley's natural theology, he was challenging not only a scientific theory, but a much broader, culturally entrenched mindset. The last influence that Paley had on Darwin is in terms of science itself, both his methodology and what he was arguing for, or in this case, against. Since we have only 25 minutes, I'm going to skip the more famous case of design in the eye. If you want to talk to me afterwards, I can get you a copy of the full paper, and you guys can read that yourself. We're going to go on to the fish's air bladder. The fish air bladder was what Paley called a plain and direct instance of contrivance. The organ allows fish to remain suspended in water and to rise or fall by compressing the air within it. Paley boldly states that the principle of the contrivance is clear. The application of the principle is also clear. He also rather brashly adds that nothing similar to the air bladder is found in land animals. When Darwin wrote Origin of Species, this is part of his response to Paley's ideas. He says, "The illustration of the swim bladder in fishes is a good one because it shows us clearly the highly important fact that an organ originally constructed for one purpose, namely flotation, may be converted into one for a wholly different purpose, namely respiration. All physiologists admit that the swim bladder is homologous or ideally similar in position and structure with the lungs of the higher vertebrate animals. Hence, there seems to me no great difficulty in believing that natural selection has actually converted a swim bladder into a lung or organ used exclusively for respiration. So by questioning the direct design of the lung, pointing to it as a naturally selected variant of the swim bladder, Darwin is actually also questioning the foundation of the argument for design in the swim bladder itself. The lung appears to be admirably suited to its work, as Paley elsewhere argues, and yet it also seems to be a recycled part. Darwin asks, why, on the theory of creation, should this be so? Why should all the parts and organs of many independent beings, each supposed to be, have been separately created for its proper place in nature, be so invariably linked together by graduated steps? So Darwin soundly rejects Paley's interpretation of the data and introduces his own. Thus, we see that where Darwin disagrees with Paley scientifically, he tends to reject him whole scale. Yet even in this context, he cannot escape Paley's influence. He's always interacting with Paley's ideas, whether it's culturally, methodologically, or scientifically. The deeper cultural implications of Paley's views on design would not allow Darwin to simply drop them and move on. This plays a crucial part in his conversations with Asa Gray about design and nature, since Gray lived in the pioneer society of the United States, where, for example, the equality of all men was considered a truth that was self-evident, and people were supposed to have unalienable rights, kind of different from the British system at this time. Also, Gray was the son of a laborer. He was a son of a tanner from the hamlet of Sauquot. And Gray did not experience the same deep ties to Paley's work that Darwin, who was the son of a respected physician and part of the landed gentry, felt. While Gray read Paley, he was able to pick and choose amongst the teleological arguments, while Darwin, who was so entrenched, was forced into a dichotomy of all or nothing. And he chose nothing. Now we're finally going to get on to the promised correspondence. In the years following the publication of Origin of Species, Asa Gray wrote prolifically about Darwin. One long essay and an extended conversation with another reader are found in the American Journal of Science and Arts, and three long essay reviews were written for the Atlantic Monthly. Here, Gray abandons the idea that design can ever be proven. He says, now let it be remarked that design can never be demonstrated. Witnessing the act does not make known the design. This is, in my opinion, Gray's greatest departure from Paley. Gray states, evidence of design, I think you will allow, everywhere is drawn from the observation of adaptations and of results, and has really nothing to do with anything else, except where you can take the word for the will. And in that case, you have not argument for design, but testimony. In nature, we have no testimony, but the argument is overwhelming. Darwin, on the other hand, had been taught to seek proofs of design due to his immersion in Paleian categories. These areas of proof can be organized into three major classifications. First is beneficence, second is perfect adaptation, and the third is intelligent design in that more ancient way that we talked about earlier. Each of these was meant to show that nature had to have a wise designer, a detailed and skilled craftsman, like a master clockmaker. The first of these proofs, the idea that nature is benevolent, comes up early in the correspondence. In Darwin's first letter to Gray, he states, but I own that I cannot see as plainly as others do, and as I should wish to do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to me to be too much misery in the world. He goes on to describe the specific providence of his hesitancy. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae wasp with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice. So Darwin's encounter with the sometimes harsh and painful realities of nature threw a shadow over his ability to reconcile himself to a good creator. He later confesses, "I grieve to say that I cannot honestly go as far as you do about design. To take a crucial example, you lead me to infer that you believe that variation has been led along certain beneficial lines. I cannot believe this." Variation, argued Darwin, could be beneficial, or, especially under domestication, if it's artificially selected, they could be detrimental to the animal, or of no use whatsoever. Darwin saw that by studying domestic variations, one could see what he says was, quote, "what an enormous field of undesigned variability there is ready for natural selection to appropriate for any purpose," end quote. This led him into conflict with Paley's insistence that variations, because they were designed, must always be beneficial. The second question is that of perfect adaptation, the idea that each creature is perfectly suited to its native environment. Now, Darwin had already rejected this by the time he wrote Origin of Species, where he observes, "The degree of adaptation of species to the climates under which they live is often overrated." Yet he struggled greatly with the concept that mankind was designed. He notes to Gray that if anything is designed, certainly man must be. One's inner conscience, though a false guide, tells one so. "Yet I cannot admit that man's rudimentary mammae, bladder drained as if he went on all four legs, and pug nose, were designed." So Darwin fought with the belief that design existed when there were so many examples of poor design that were certainly inherited and modified, thus compromising function. When the great naturalist struggled with the last of the Paleian categories, and I think he really did truly struggle with this, that of intelligent design, he made several important mental leaps. First, he identifies design with some sort of preordination. In Darwin's mind, if something is designed, it's also controlled. So he poses the following predicament to Gray. He says, an innocent and good man, stands under a tree and is killed by a flash of lightning. Do you believe, and I should really like to hear, that God designedly killed this man? So he goes on to answer his own question. Many or most persons do believe this. I can't and don't. If you believe so, do you believe that when a swallow snaps up a gnat, that God designed that that particular swallow should snap up that particular gnat at that particular instant? Here we see Darwin pressing Gray into a corner regarding how to understand the theological nuances of intervention and divine sovereignty. His logic climaxes with this statement, "I believe that the man and the gnat are in the same predicament. If the death of neither man or gnat are designed, I see no good reason to believe that their first birth or production should necessarily be designed." So Darwin ultimately rejected the micro-control of divine sovereignty. Yet on a macro scale, he still couldn't believe that all the wonders of the universe were entirely random. The beauty, complexity, and functionality of the results of all these processes amazed him. His clearest statement of his position regarding the role of intervention comes in the first letter, where, after he speaks of the ubiquitous cruelty of nature, the cat playing with mice and ichneumonidae wasps, he ponders, "On the other hand, I cannot anyhow be contented to view this wonderful universe, and especially the nature of man, and to conclude that everything is the result of brute force. I am inclined to look at everything as resulting from designed laws, with the details, whether good or bad, left to the working out of what we may call chance." Unwilling to adopt atheism due to the intuitive force of the design argument, yet still feeling that he could not look at each separate thing as the result of design as Paley did, Darwin eventually settled into a state he liked to call being, quote, "in thick mud," end quote. Darwin's continual refrain through the exchange with Gray is, he says, "My mind is in a simple muddle." He repeats some version of it in almost every letter. He says, I feel most deeply that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton. And the more I think, the more bewildered I become. The continual struggle led to an eventual impasse where Darwin could neither admit that there was a God designing the universe, nor could he persuade himself that the world, as we see it, is the result of chance. In one insightful passage, Darwin compares the problem of design to the issues of free will. He says, but I know that I am in the same sort of muddle, as I have said before, as all the world seems to be in with respect to free will, yet with every action supposed to have been foreseen or preordained. It's a very good analogy, one which sets forth the impossibility of proving either design or free will. Darwin settles on design where the Arminians settle on free will, sort of in paradox. He's convinced that the universe is more than a random coincidence, yet his inability to imagine how design could be proved if it is not present in the smallest of acts, such as a swallow eating a gnat, keeps him from settling on the issue. At one point, Asa Gray says, okay, Darwin, what would prove design to you beyond any shadow of a doubt? Darwin's answer, I think, is quite telling. He says, your question, what would convince me of design, is a poser. If I saw an angel come down to teach us good, and I was convinced from others seeing him that I was not mad, I should believe in design. If I could be convinced thoroughly that life and mind was in an unknown way a function of other imponderable forces, I should be convinced. If man was made of brass or iron and no way connected with any other organism which had ever lived, I should perhaps be convinced. But this is childish writing. We can see here that Darwin will only believe in design if some supernatural event could be shown to him. In the second part of his answer, he speaks of wanting a man of brass or iron to prove design. Personally, I wonder if a tin man would do, but, you know, it could have been solved. Regardless, he wants something that's unrelated to anything else, and this is more profound than it initially appears. Well, using an absurd example, Darwin is asking for an interventionistic divine action, that is, for an act of creation which could prove to him the reality of God's work in the world. In the next letter, he picks this up again. He says, I should believe it to have been designed, as I did formerly each part of each animal, until I saw a way of its being formed without design. When I think of my beloved orchids, it really seems to me incredibly monstrous to look at an orchid as created as we now see it. Every part reveals modification on modification. This evidence suggests that Darwin felt that design happening through modification was impossible. So his definition of design is an independent act of creation. And this, I think, is where the search for design ultimately fails. Asa Gray, on the other hand, was able to leave behind Paley's view that only the God of the gaps is worthy of being recognized in nature. In one of his letters, Gray responds that the implication of a designing mind must bring with it a strong implication of design in matters where we could not directly prove it. If you grant an intelligent designer anywhere in nature, you may be confident that he has had something to do with the contrivances in your orchids. This sentiment that God is at work precisely in the natural processes and not in spite of it is echoed in his reviews of Darwin's Origin of Species. The problem with this view, with Asa Gray's view, is that some, like Charles Hodge, accused such a view as being atheistical. Is this atheism if you can't prove design? If God doesn't have to intervene, if he doesn't seem to have any role at all, is it in fact disguised atheism? Gray writes that it would be more correct to say that the theory in itself is perfectly compatible with an atheistic view of the universe. That is true, but it is equally true of physical theories generally. Indeed, it is more true of the theory of gravitation and of the nebular hypothesis than of the hypothesis in question. I've lost my place here. Excellent. There we go. He goes on to remind his readers how belief in gravity in no way undermines belief in God's ordering of the universe, despite gravity having necessarily resulted in planetary orbs and the exquisite cosmic order. Gray builds this argument with a sort of natural predestination in which the actions of God are understood as done from all time, or as he says, doing through all time. A nice Calvinist sort of framework by the Presbyterian.